is VOA News V Remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Britain's Queen Elizabeth II will receive the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine within weeks, reports Sunday said, as the biggest immunization program in UK history begins next week. Due to their age, the monarch, who is 94, and her 99-year-old husband, Prince Philip, are in line to get the jab early in the rollout, which starts Tuesday. The Sunday Times newspaper said that Britain's most senior royals will let it be known that they have been given the inoculations as a powerful counter to the anti-vaccination movement. Britain on Wednesday became the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. It has pre-ordered 40 million doses in total and is set to receive an initial batch of 800,000 to kickstart Tuesday's rollout. Frontline healthcare workers and elderly care staff and residents will receive priority along with other elderly people. Pfizer Incorporated has applied for emergency use authorization of its coronavirus vaccine in India. Media said on Sunday, the first to do so in a country with the world's second highest number of infections. South Korea will impose heightened social distancing rules for the capital, Seoul, and surrounding areas, health officials said on Sunday, as authorities struggle to contain the nation's largest wave of coronavirus infections in 9 months. The decision comes after the government implemented unprecedented measures on Saturday in a country that had seen initial success through aggressive contact tracing and other steps. Mainland China reported 18 new COVID-19 cases on December 5th, up from 17 cases from a day earlier, the country's National Health Authority said on Sunday. The National Health Commission added that 17 of the new cases were imported. This is VOA News. Moscow wants to vaccinate up to 7 million people, its mayor told state TV, as Russia on Sunday reported yet another record high number of new COVID-19 cases. Moscow began distributing its Sputnik V COVID-19 shot via 70 clinics on Saturday to the most exposed groups, marking Russia's first large-scale vaccination against the disease. Russia reported a record daily increase of 29,039 new cases, taking the national total to over 2.4 million since the pandemic began, while the official national death toll rose to more than 43,100. Russia, which has the world's fourth highest number of coronavirus cases, puts high hopes on its vaccines, but some scientists have raised concerns about the speed at which it gave the regulatory go-ahead and began giving people shots. An influential Saudi prince launched a bitter attack on Israel at a regional conference Sunday, drawing retorts from the Jewish state's foreign minister, who addressed the gathering virtually. The row erupted months after the UAE and Bahrain broke decades of Arab consensus by normalizing ties with Israel, a move condemned as a stab in the back by Palestinians. It also undermines the Saudi-sponsored 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, which maintained that Arab states would not establish relations with the Jewish state until it made peace with the Palestinians. The prince, who is a former Saudi intelligence chief and said to be close to the country's leadership, reiterated strong support for the Palestinian cause in a presentation to the Manama Dialogue Security Forum. He called the Jewish state a Western colonizing power that evicted Palestinians, destroyed villages, and assassinated whomever they want. Israel's foreign minister addressed the meeting by video conference shortly after, expressing his regret over the comments, and he later tweeted that they don't reflect the facts or the spirit and changes that the region is undergoing. Despite the prince's rhetoric, mutual concern over Iran has gradually brought Israel and Gulf nations closer. Cameroon on Sunday held its first indirect regional elections. The president called the elections, some say to defuse the separatist insurgency in the English-speaking West, but the opposition is boycotting it as a sham. In Sunday's election, a 24,000-strong electoral college made up of municipal councilors and traditional chiefs will vote to fill the posts of 900 regional councilors, 90 for each of the country's 10 regions. But the municipal councils that have the greatest proportion of votes is already dominated by the 87-year-old president. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this U.S. politics edition of the program, 1 month after former Vice President Joe Biden was declared the projected winner of the 2020 election, U.S. President Donald Trump continues efforts without success to overturn the results. And control of the Senate hangs in the balance. Two runoff elections in the southern state of Georgia on January 5th, 2021 will determine whether Republicans retain control of the upper chamber of Congress or if the Democrats prevail. Republicans currently hold 50 Senate seats, with Democrats holding 48. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Trump's allegations that the 2020 elections were rife with fraud have been repeatedly rejected by state election officials as well as by the courts. Many Republican lawmakers are beginning to say publicly that the pathway for the president to overturn the outcome has narrowed, if not completely closed. Even Attorney General William Barr told the Associated Press this week that he has not seen any evidence of fraud that would swing the election outcome in Mr. Trump's favor. Nonetheless, several Republican lawmakers have yet to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden on his win. In the meantime, the incoming administration of President-elect Joe Biden forges ahead with its transition to power. Mr. Biden now has access to critical national security briefings. He has also unveiled his picks for key foreign and national security, as well as economic cabinet posts. His communications team is comprised entirely of women. And in a last-ditch effort to cobble together a coronavirus relief package before the end of December, a bipartisan group of senators have revived stalled talks that appear to be gaining support. The measure is more than what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had originally offered, but less than what Democrats in the House of Representatives wanted. Nonetheless, there are positive signs that compromise may be within reach. For more on the Biden transition, the runoff elections in Georgia, and President Trump's refusal to concede, we turn to our veteran political analysts. John Fortier is Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center. That's a prominent think tank here in Washington. And Jim Kessler is Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way, a centrist policy group also based here in Washington. And as usual, both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance. Welcome back to the program. John, let me begin with you. Joe Biden has garnered the 306 electoral votes, more than the 270 needed for the win. He's gotten about 7 million more votes than Mr. Trump, and yet the president continues to challenge the results. Why do you think that's the case?
I think the election result is clear and isn't going to change. Joe Biden is going to be president on January 20th. All sorts of things you could point to on the Republican side that would be more positive than expected, better results in the Congress, a better showing for President Trump. It was actually quite a close election in the Electoral College sense, similar to the 2016 election, where then Donald Trump won three states by pretty close margins. This election came down to three states that Joe Biden won. Clearly, Joe Biden also had a bigger popular vote win. I think the early contention of the election was arguably warranted. We had a longer counting period and some issues that arose. But really, for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, I think the president's challenges, legal challenges and others, really have been falling flat. And so I don't think there's anything that's going to change about that. And we're going to go forward. So again, there are people making arguments against what happened in the electoral process. Maybe there's some legitimate, and I think there are probably some legitimate questions about what we should do in the future and how we reform our election system. But I don't think there's any doubt. And so I think the president's efforts are really not going anywhere. And eventually, he said that when the Electoral College votes, and that's on December 14th, if there's a clearer result, he's going to accept that. I'm going to take him at his word at that. So I think maybe we'll have some resolution relatively soon. But again, I don't think the outcome is going to change, and Joe Biden will become president on January 20th.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, John Fortier makes a very good point that many of the down-ballot races were won by Republicans, contrary to what Democrats had wanted. But nonetheless, it's President Trump who continues to challenge the results. Why are so many Republican lawmakers not pushing him to accept these results? Because the attempts in the courts and challenging electoral officials in many of these key states has not been working.
So Donald Trump foreshadowed this at the Republican convention. He spent particularly the last day of the convention in his own speech talking about how this election is going to be stolen from him. And I think it was because of a belief by him and his advisors that there was no way he could win a free and fair election. I think they just felt they were not going to be able to win, so let's poison the water here as much as possible. And he is playing that up all the way through. I think what the president is doing right now, it's obviously wrong. I mean, virtually nobody who has an official Republican position believes that this election was fraudulent and that the election was stolen from him, except for a couple of crackpots. Unfortunately, President Trump is one of those crackpots, and I think this is doing some serious damage to the country and to our institutions that is going to be long-lasting. Nothing that Donald Trump is doing is surprising to me. What is surprising to me is the reticence of many Republican leaders to call him on it and say, enough is enough. And the truth of the matter is, they're still afraid of Donald Trump. They're afraid of him posting a negative tweet about him. My feeling is if you're afraid of a negative tweet from Donald Trump, maybe you shouldn't be in office in the first place. Maybe you don't have the courage to be serving this country.
Turning back to you, John Fortier, Mr. Trump has had now only unsuccessful attempts to overturn the election. And I was wondering what you think it says about our state election officials. Many analysts are saying that they are truly heroes in the sense that many of them are Republican, and many of them have expressed quite a bit of dismay about Mr. Trump's criticism of them and their administration of the election, in which they take considerable pride. In particular, this election took place during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. So the fact that it did take place extremely well, as expressed by the cybersecurity official who was fired by Mr. Trump. So again, what does this say about our system? And particularly, as Jim said, you know, he's concerned about doing serious damage to our country and particularly our processes and institutions.
Well, I do think that election officials, the thousands of them across the country, have done a very good job under extremely difficult circumstances. I think in general, we forget how important they are. And of course, this election, with all the changes we've made and all the conditions of the pandemic, I concur that they should generally be praised. If there is some argument that the president is making, and again, I don't think those arguments are going to change any votes or should really change the outcomes, it's more with policymakers and courts and others who've changed the law. And so I think there's room for a robust discussion after the election about what worked and what didn't, and whether we should be doing more voting by mail or allowing more observers. All of those are legitimate topics to talk about. And I think Republicans and Trump will have some points on that. Again, I think the election officials are to be praised, but let's have a debate about how we run elections. After this election is all said and done, let's have that debate.
Jim Kessler, notwithstanding any flaws in the conduct of the election, none of which amounts to the ability to overturn the results, which were decisively in favor of Joe Biden, you had brought up the point that you're concerned about the impact that the kind of words that Mr. Trump is uttering with regard to our system, as if it's not working properly. How concerned are you? Because this is what some consider disinformation. And there's concern that even among these very stalwart Republican election officials and many governors, particularly the one in Georgia, who is a staunch Trump supporter, this is worrisome in the long run, as you said.
Yeah, I think disinformation is a very polite term for what's happening here. I think what the president is doing is sabotaging our institutions. I mean, look, I've never been a fan of Donald Trump. I've always worried not just about his policies. I think policies are policy debates, and Republicans win and they do policies that I don't necessarily approve of, but they fall within a spectrum of, you know, what happens in this country. But what he's doing with the institutions of this country are troubling, is a mild word for it. I'm very, very worried about what it means. And I agree with John that, you know, we can look at this election. I think there's lessons to be learned. It had the highest turnout in over 100 years because we made it easier for people to vote, and people had to vote in oftentimes in a different way. And I think for the most part, election officials really did a good job on this. But the fact that we had to worry about what a couple of appointed people in Michigan were going to do and being invited to the White House to be lobbied to essentially not certify the state's election. Like, that is scary stuff. That is stuff that I just did not think was possible in this country. And as I said earlier, nothing that Donald Trump does surprises me. I think he is a person who only looks out for himself. I don't believe he has America's interests at heart and ever has. But what has shocked me is Republican legislators in the House and Senate that have gone along with it because they feel that it helps them in their political calculation. And at some point, I'm just looking for some spine here. And, you know, you see it with some, with Mitt Romney, and you saw it with the Secretary of State in Georgia, and you've seen it with some other Republicans. But step up here. This is your country that you're protecting right now. This is not some sort of game.
In addition to this disinformation, there are a number of threats on people's lives, which I think has many people worried. Threats against election workers as if they were responsible for the results. One of the top election officials in Georgia was very concerned that people's lives were in the balance because Mr. Trump didn't win, that they were somehow responsible, and that the threats on lives. So that was quite a bit worrisome.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Secretary of State of Georgia, who is a Republican and a Trump voter and a Trump donor, said, please, President Trump, say stop this. And the president has refused to do it.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, co-founder and Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. We're discussing President-elect Biden's transition and implications of his cabinet nominees and, of course, the Georgia elections. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Kashia Johanna from Kaduna, Nigeria. As always, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Also this weekend, tune in to my Press Conference USA with former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Hank Cohen, discussing his new book, U.S. Policy Toward Africa, 8 Decades of Realpolitik. My colleague James Butte, managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa, and I talk with Ambassador Cohen about U.S. Africa policy from Franklin D. Roosevelt to Donald J. Trump. Ambassador Cohen shares anecdotes and insights garnered over his distinguished 38-year career as a diplomat involved in some of the most delicate negotiations on the African continent. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. And now back to our Encounter program. Well, back to you, John Fortier. Quickly, let's go to the Georgia elections, because as I said in the introduction, a lot is at stake. Republican Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue are facing off Democrat John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock, the Democrats. So talk about the stakes in this election and the drawback about runoffs. They generally don't turn out as many people. But do you think because of the high stakes, because these elections could determine the control of the Senate, do you think that more people will turn out?
Well, I think you're right, Carol. This is the last piece of the election, and it is high stakes. If Democrats were to win both of those seats, they would have a narrow majority. They would have 50-50 in the Senate, and the Vice President Kamala Harris would break ties. And while that still is a difficult position and far short of some of the hopes that Democrats had of large majorities in the Senate and a very aggressive agenda, it's still good to have that majority. And there will be things that Democrats and the Biden administration can do that are along their agenda. Always hard to hold your coalition together, but there will be things they can do. If, on the other hand, Republicans win one or both of those seats, and I do think that is more likely, then it is Joe Biden with divided government. Winning the presidency still means a lot. There are a lot of things the administration can do by itself in terms of personnel and representing around the world and executive actions. But in terms of a legislative agenda, the idea that any of the major products of the Biden administration are going to go through in any sort of form that they would have hoped is not going to happen. There hopefully will be some compromise measures, and we'll deal with the budget, and we'll hopefully have some emergency relief for COVID, but it will be a much smaller set of things that the parties can agree on. So it's a big deal. What happens in runoff elections? They do tend to be different than the presidential. Yes, this is going to be our most high stakes runoff election ever. It's both a following on our highest turnout election and it is important for the Senate control. So yes, the amount of money is going to be spent there is going to be enormous, and the attention is going to be high. So it will be higher than a typical runoff. And, you know, some of the dynamic which will likely come out is that many people on the Democratic side of people voted for Joe Biden were very, very intense about voting out Donald Trump. And yes, you could say this is an additional message to Trump if you want, but it's not the same thing as actually casting a ballot to kick someone out. And so polling early on is very hard to judge. I've seen some good polling for Democrats, but I think the dynamics of this election are probably more likely to favor Republicans. Their voters are more likely to turn out, and Democratic voters are not going to be as enthusiastic as they were during the presidential election.
Well, I'd like to challenge you on that. So turning to you, Jim Kessler, in terms of the turnout for Republicans, some analysts are saying because President Trump said that the elections were rigged in November, that this could discourage turnout by Republicans and that they may say, well, what's the point if these elections are rigged? And that could dampen Republicans. On the other side, perhaps Democrats are energized about the fact that these elections could determine the control of the Senate in favor of Democrats if they come out and vote. What is your take on the prospects?
This is the cherry on the sundae of the craziest election season in history. I think turnout is going to be high. I agree with John. It won't be as high as the presidential race, but it'll be very high compared to a normal Senate race, let alone two Senate races and a runoff. If you look at how Democrats did down ballot, in almost every state, almost every congressional district, Joe Biden did better than the Democrat that was running behind him for Congress or for Senate. And in a state as close as Georgia, I think that gives Republicans a slight edge. Georgia was the big surprise of all the states going for Joe Biden, but it went by razor-thin majority. So I think Republicans have a slight edge here. The places where I think Democrats have a bit of an advantage in this race are really twofold. Number one is neither of the Republicans who are running in Georgia are great candidates. They each have their own scandals having to do with insider trading. And one of the candidates, Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed in the first place, just is not well-liked. So they don't have great candidates. And the other is, as you pointed out, Carol, some of the residuals of Donald Trump saying this election is a fraud is causing a mini movement on the far right to say, well, don't even show up for this election. I'm a little bit skeptical that those people really aren't going to show up. I think some of this is really Twitter tantrums and not real tantrums. But this is a race in which a few thousand votes could make a difference. I think it's close to a coin flip. I give the advantage to the Republicans here, slight.
All right. Well, if that is the case, John Forte, let's say Republicans narrowly control the Senate. What about the theory that even though Joe Biden won't be able to get everything he would like if he had a democratically controlled Senate, do you foresee some of the so-called Republican moderates like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney voting with the Democrats from time to time, and the fact that Joe Biden has these long-standing relationships with many of these Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell? Do you think Mitch McConnell will behave a bit differently without Mr. Trump in the Oval Office? Love to get your view on that.
Look, I do think Joe Biden, both his history, especially his history in the Senate, but also as vice president working with Congress, gives this president a better chance to work across the aisle than others. But I also think you have to realize the dynamic, I think, is not going to be great for legislative purposes. And I think the one thing we forget is in the most optimistic moments of Democrats hoping that they were getting large majorities in both houses was they were going to get rid of the filibuster, or they were going to at least chip away at it and have some major legislation be able to be passed on a majority basis in the Senate. That's not going to happen, even with a 50-50 Senate. So even if you do have moderates joining sometimes with Democrats, it might not be enough. The Republicans both will have some power to schedule what they vote on, but also to resist a majority other than a supermajority of passing anything. So I think the dynamic is still going to be very difficult. Remember the trivia point that Joe Biden, if those races, one of those races in Georgia goes against him, will be the first Democratic president to come in without Congress in Democratic hands since Grover Cleveland in the 19th century. you know, it's been a long time, and it's a hard thing. And I do think the president will start off at a disadvantage. And there will be some ability to work on some discrete things. I think Joe Biden's ability to do that might yield some compromise, smaller things, work on the budget, maybe work on COVID matters early on. But I don't think it really portends that moderate Republicans will be working with Democrats regularly on a Democratic agenda. I think that will be a small piece of what might happen.
Anything to add or subtract to that, Jim Kessler?
I'm a bit more optimistic for the following reasons. I do believe that Joe Biden is the right person to be leading in divided government. These are the cards he knows how to play best. So he is the right person here. The other thing is, because the country is in the middle of a crisis, there is going to have to be some sort of action. And we're seeing already in the waning days of the Trump administration, a bipartisan agreement on a COVID relief package that may be the future of how things get done. The final thing to add is there are 5 pieces of legislation that absolutely will have to move in 2021. So there are hands that are going to be dealt and pots that are going to be won at the poker table. The question is, will they be small deals, big deals, or medium deals? We don't know, but there is certain pieces of legislation that absolutely have to move. There are tax provisions that expire from the Trump tax bill from 2017. There's a debt ceiling that's going to be breached. There are other things. So those are action-enforcing events. And these leaders, Biden and McConnell, they know how to get things done. So I'm a bit more optimistic than John.
Jim Kessler, do you think we'll have this limited COVID relief package by the end of the year?
I do.
What do you think, John Fortier?
I think there's a good chance of it. Again, and I do agree with Jim that anytime you're bargaining over money or and there's an ability to horse trade on things, you could get a deal. It's just the size of that deal and how extensive it is really what will be the question.
John Fortier, before we close, let's just get your take on President-elect Biden's choices for cabinet officials from the foreign and national security team to the economic team. What do these choices tell us about the direction Joe Biden would like to take the country, both economically and then on the foreign and national security fronts?
So more generally about the transition, I know we had a minor controversy about some funds being released for the transition, and that has now been resolved. I actually think Joe Biden is well positioned to have a good transition, both who he is, what he's done, but also the start that he's made. And if you think of some of the past failures, you think of presidents who came in from the outside, like Jimmy Carter, to some extent Bill Clinton, who really did not have a White House in place with key people who knew how to run White Houses and knew Washington. And you know, that's something I think Joe Biden has done very well at. He's put key experienced people and people who worked with him, like his chief of staff, Ron Klain, in places. And I think that's the most important thing. I think the cabinet positions are important, but for a start to a presidency, I think Joe Biden has made a lot of good moves in that respect. The thing I would note about his set of nominations is, you know, they're generally more moderate Democrats, or at least the idea that they were going to give a lot of posts to the Sanders wing of the party has not borne fruit. And that's interesting, and interesting to see what the reaction will be to that. But it has been more establishment Democrats, more allies of Biden, and really not as many people who are more in the Sanders wing of the party.
So the last word to you, Jim Kessler, on the way in which Biden is dealing with the transition and his choices for both foreign policy and his economic team.
Very good start, very steady, very confident steps by Joe Biden. Agree with John. His picks lean more towards the moderate wing of the party, which is who Joe Biden is, than the more progressive wing. A lot of diversity in his picks, both in gender, race, and ethnicity. So that is satisfying a lot of people. There's just a great deal of competence in these picks. And, you know, so far, so good. And I just also want to say, Bernie Sanders isn't getting a lot of the picks that I think he'd hoped, but Bernie Sanders has been pretty supportive of what Joe Biden has been doing thus far, and he's been a real team player, and that has mattered.
Gentlemen, on that note, that's all the time we have on this politics edition of Encounter, but I will see you at these microphones after the Georgia runoff elections, and I look forward to that. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Once again, gentlemen, thanks so much for a terrific conversation.
Thanks, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dr. Jill Robbins tells us ways to inspect our own writing. Brian Lynn talks about a new type of meat and how Singapore has approved its sale. I will return with this week's words and their stories. I will explain the expression carrot and stick approach. Finally, we end our 30 minutes together with the making of a nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins with the education report.
Recently, someone asked us, "Can you please tell me who is the highest authority or is the most respected resource regarding writing rules?" There are several excellent sources on writing rules. However, the rules are different for different fields, such as business, technology, government, or academic writing. Full-time writers often turn to a handbook, such as Strunk and White's The Elements of Style. This book, published in 1959, combined the earlier work of William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White, the writer of several popular children's books. The Elements of Style has simple rules for good writing. You can get the 1920 version of the book free on Project Gutenberg. More recent versions deal with issues of gender and changes in punctuation. Students writing a report for school may use a book like the Chicago Manual of Style from the University of Chicago. The Chicago Manual deals with English grammar and how to prepare an academic paper. It was first published in 1906. Kate L. Turabian's Manual for Writers of Research Papers, Theses and Dissertations is based on the Chicago Manual. Her work is especially helpful for high school and college students. It is available free online. An excellent place to look for help with writing is Purdue University's Online Writing Lab, or OWL for short. As noted earlier, technical and professional writing is different from what teachers expect of writing in school. So Purdue OWL has a guide for writing business letters and technical materials. The OWL has helpful resources for writing teachers who are working remotely, too. Teachers can download presentations on many subjects related to writing. Another English learner asked us how to avoid plagiarism when writing. Plagiarism is when someone takes another person's work and passes it off as their own. Many schools publish students severely for copying the words of another writer. For those learning English, writing has different problems, and to help them, the OWL has one part especially for ESL students. It includes an explanation of how American schools deal with plagiarism. When students find information on the internet, it is too easy to copy it and put it directly into their own written work. To avoid this, the OWL urges you to take more time to deeply understand what you read. Begin by looking at books and printed materials before turning to the internet. When you find information on the internet, write down notes by hand in a notebook. As you write, put the ideas into your own words. This process is called paraphrasing. Think about the meaning of the whole work. You want to tell your reader how this information is related to your own ideas. If you use another writer's exact words, make sure to place quotation marks before and after them. And tell your reader how to find the original source. The guides I named earlier in this report explain how to quote work in different styles of writing. If you are not sure about how well you paraphrased another writer's work, there are online tools that will tell you how closely your work resembles that of someone else. Ask your school which tool they suggest. Or you can take a few lines from your written work and copy them into an internet search engine. If they are the same as another published work, the search result will probably identify that work. Another good way to test your writing is to read it aloud and see if it is easy to understand. Ask a friend or family member to listen as you read it and tell you if they can understand. Writing well is not easy, but when finished, you will have a good feeling. You have communicated your ideas to others clearly. I'm Jill Robbins.
Next, Brian Lin brings us a food science story.
Singapore's government has approved the sale of a laboratory-grown chicken meat. The American company that invented the product, Eat Just, says it is the first time lab-grown meat has received such approval anywhere in the world. Lab-grown meat, also called clean or cultured meat, is created from animal cells in a laboratory. The product is made without harming animals. The cells grow directly into the meat outside of any animal. The Eat Just product is to be sold as small pieces, called nuggets. The product is set to launch at a Singapore restaurant in the very near term, the company's CEO, Josh Tetrick, told Reuters news agency. Singapore is an island city-state of 5.7 million people. Demand for alternatives to animal meat is rising across the world, because of public concerns about health, animal welfare, and the environment. Plant-based products, popularized by companies like Beyond Meat, Impossible Foods, and Corn, are selling in a growing number of stores and restaurants. But the development of lab-grown meat has been much slower than that of plant-based versions. The main reason for the delay is money. Lab-grown meat costs a lot more to produce. Tetrick said the San Francisco-based company is also seeking approvals from U.S. government agencies. But he added that Singapore was a good bit ahead of the United States. The Singapore Food Agency said it examined data from processing, manufacturing control, and safety testing before approving Eat Just sales. Tetrick said it is likely that the U.S. and countries in Europe and elsewhere will examine Singapore's approval system and will attempt to create a similar process. Eat Just said it will manufacture the product in Singapore. The company also plans to start making a plant-based egg substitute there that it is already selling in the United States. Eat Just was founded in 2011 and has raised more than $300 million, Tetrick said. The company is valued at around $1.2 billion. Worldwide, more than 24 companies are testing lab-grown fish, cow, and chicken meat. They are hoping to break into a new part of the alternative meat market. Financial experts at Barclays Bank have estimated the market could be worth up to $140 billion by 2029. Competitors in the market have also been able to raise large amounts of money and win support from well-known investors. U.S.-based Memphis Meats raised money this year in a deal led by Japan's SoftBank Group and Singapore-based Temasek. Among the Memphis Meats investors are Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Virgin Group chief Richard Branson. In Singapore, Shiok Meats aims to become the first company to sell lab-grown shrimp. The company is backed by Harry Sosanto of the Philippines' Mondnisin Corporation, which also owns corn. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. There are many ways to get people to do what you want. You can threaten them with punishment. You can also entice others with a reward. In other words, they will get something in return for some effort or service. Naturally, you can also just ask nicely. But for now, we will talk about threatening and enticing, two effective but different methods of persuasion. First, let's talk about these important words. When we persuade someone, we try to make them do something. We can entice them or offer them something very desirable. We can also make threats or promise harm. Sometimes we do both. One way of saying this is what we call the carrot and stick approach. You can say it is a method of persuasion that involves both a reward and punishment. When given a choice, most people will surely take the carrot, a popular vegetable, instead of the stick, which could hurt. For example, let's say a company has a carrot and stick approach to vacation days. They entice people to work hard by giving lots of time for paid vacations. That is the carrot. But they also threaten to take away those hours if employees refuse to work hard. That is the punishment, or stick. When we say stick, we don't mean giving a stick, we mean hitting with a stick. This kind of system may work well for some workers, but not for others. It depends on what motivates you. Do you like your work? In addition to getting paid, what satisfaction do you get from the job? Or are you only working for a paycheck? When using the carrot and stick method, it is also important to carefully consider the reward and punishment. If you do not want the carrot, you are not going to be motivated to do the work. Also, if the punishment is meaningless to you, it will not motivate you either. Many word historians say the origin of the expression carrot and stick approach is unclear. But some say it comes from the custom of urging a donkey to move forward by hanging a carrot in front of it. If it refuses to move, the caretaker might decide to hit the animal with a stick. Here is another example. The parents tried using a carrot and stick approach with their teenage daughter. They promised her a new phone if she brought up her grades, and threatened to take away her current phone if her grades dropped even lower. When it comes to learning English, a carrot and stick approach is not a good motivational tool. We here at VOA Learning English can only reward you with praise, and we promise not to punish you, nor would we want to. So I think the only thing we are giving out here is carrots. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Ulysses Grant was elected President of the United States in 1868. Grant was a military hero. He led Union troops of the North to victory over Confederate troops of the South in the Civil War. Grant was extremely popular, but he was a much better general than he was a politician. As president, it was not long before he got into trouble in the battles of politics and government. Larry West and Frank Oliver talk about the first term of President Ulysses Grant.
Grant resigned from the army to run for president. However, he ran on his record as a winning general. "Let us have peace," he often said, and the people believed he would guarantee peace. In fact, Grant guaranteed nothing. As a presidential candidate, he offered no new national programs. So, as president, he had no new policies to carry out. He had few struggles with Congress, because he rarely asked Congress to do anything. Many events took place during Grant's two administrations, but he usually was not involved directly. He had problems only because he was linked indirectly to the men who were responsible.
One of President Grant's first problems was caused by two of his friends. They tried to take control of the gold market. The men were Jay Gould and James Fisk. Both were extremely rich. Gould and Fisk developed a plan to buy a large part of the nation's gold supply when the price was low. They would hold the gold until demand greatly increased the price. Then they would sell it and make a lot of money. To be successful, they had to prevent the government from selling gold on the market. Government sales of gold would keep the price down. So Gould and Fisk urged President Grant to stop the Treasury Department from selling gold. Grant refused to give them a firm promise.
The two men brought one of Grant's relatives into their plan. They paid him to write a letter to the president. It asked the president to halt government sales of gold. A messenger took the letter to the White House. He then sent a telegram to James Fisk saying the letter had been delivered. The telegram said, "Letter delivered. All right." Fisk thought this meant that President Grant had agreed to halt government sales of gold. So he began buying gold in huge amounts. Fisk was wrong. The words "all right" meant only that the letter had been delivered. They did not mean that Grant had agreed to the plan. In fact, Grant did not agree. He ordered the Treasury Department to sell gold to block the attempt by Gould and Fisk to control the gold market.
The result was that James Fisk and Jay Gould lost a great amount of money. So did other businessmen and bankers. Many Americans blamed President Grant for not acting quickly enough to stop the activity of his two friends. Concern about Grant grew after another incident was reported at the New York Customs Office. Two of Grant's friends there became involved in a plan to get money from importers. They used their official positions to earn huge amounts of money.
Grant also was criticized for one of his few independent actions as president. He tried to buy the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. The island nation was ruled by a dictator, Buenaventura Báez. Báez was so dishonest that the people of the Dominican Republic were ready to overthrow him. Before this could happen, he offered to sell his country to the United States. When Grant received the offer, he sent a White House official to negotiate with Báez. The official returned with a treaty giving the Dominican Republic to the United States for $1.5 million. Grant immediately sent American warships to the Dominican Republic. He wanted to keep Báez in power until the treaty was completed. Grant asked the Senate to approve the treaty. Many senators opposed it. They said taking control of the Dominican Republic would cost too much money. They also said it was a bad idea for the United States to take control of any nation in the Caribbean. President Grant went to the Capitol building himself to urge senators to approve the treaty. His efforts failed. The treaty was defeated.
Grant's biggest national problem was the political situation in the former rebel states of the South. After the Civil War, most Southern states were governed by radical members of the Republican Party. radicals supported citizenship rights and voting rights for blacks. In the late 1860s, the radicals began to lose power. Many failed to be reelected to state office. They were being defeated by candidates of the Democratic Party. Democrats did not want blacks to have any rights at all.
The first radical Republicans to lose power were those in Virginia. The change there was made peacefully. Not so in other southern states. In Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina, Democrats used threats and violence to win elections. Their campaigns often were led by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was a secret organization of white men. Members believed white people were greater than black people. Wearing cloths over their faces, Klansmen broke up radical Republican political meetings. They threatened, beat, and killed blacks to keep them out of politics. They did the same thing to whites who tried to organize or help blacks.
Before long, Ku Klux Klan groups were formed in every southern state. By 1871, radical Republican congressmen were demanding a new law to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. A committee headed by radicals was named to investigate Klan activities in the South. The committee heard reports of the Klan's brutal acts. It helped prepare a bill to control the Klan. After much debate, Congress passed the bill. The new law gave the president power to declare military rule in the South. Democrats charged that the real purpose of the law was to keep radical Republican state governments in power. President Grant did not wait long to use his powers under the new law. He declared military rule in a large area of South Carolina. Thousands of people there were arrested. They were tried in federal courts. Juries were made up mainly of blacks and radical whites.
This kind of justice made Southerners feel even more bitterness toward the North. It also angered a number of moderate members of the Republican Party. They said the federal government should not help radical Republicans stay in power in the South. Some of these moderate Republicans broke away from President Grant and the radicals. They called themselves liberal Republicans and formed a new political party. They held their own presidential nominating convention for the election of 1872. They nominated Horace Greeley as their candidate. Greeley published the New York Tribune newspaper.
Democrats believed their only chance to win the election was to support the new liberal Republicans. So they, too, chose Horace Greeley as their presidential candidate. As expected, the radicals who controlled the main Republican Party nominated Grant for a second term. The campaign between Grant and Greeley was very strange. Grant made no speeches. He spent the summer at a holiday town on the Atlantic Ocean coast. His supporters, however, were not silent. They called Greeley a fool and a traitor. They refused to treat him as a serious candidate. Unlike Grant, Greeley did campaign hard, but he had little financial help. He also was hurt by a poorly organized campaign.
On election day in 1872, Ulysses Grant won a big victory. He got the votes of 31 of the 37 states. Horace Greeley died 3 weeks after the election. The new Liberal Republican Party died with him. Ulysses Grant and the Radical Republicans would govern for another 4 years.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.